This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. First up this hour, how Hurricane Ike may have saved the Hubble Space Telescope. We'll get to that. It's an interesting confluence of events. The shuttle astronauts were set to rocket off towards the Hubble Telescope on a service mission later this month, and that was a result of a delay due to Hurricane Ike doing some damage at the Kennedy Space Center, at the Johnson Space Center. In Houston, it was forced to close, and there was a delay, and that was put off until October 14th. But during that time, it was discovered that a crucial part in this telescope's computer stopped working, and that gave mission engineers time to fix it or to think of a repair and add that to their repair list. Of course, the Hubble's been flying out in space for about 18 years, so those computer components are getting pretty old by today's standards. Could this be the last straw for the aging telescope? Joining me now to chat about the Hubble and how to fix it is my guest, Ed Weiler, Associate Administrator of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Weiler.
Thank you, Ira.
So that was pretty fortuitous, that delay.
Well, actually, it was. Last Saturday night, we discovered a science data formatting chip, which is a small chip, but very important one in the telescope, failed. It basically takes all the data from all five instruments and packetizes it and then routes it to the spacecraft computer. If that chip fails, you don't get any data from the science instrument, so the telescope is effectively useless.
So it's like your router that you have.
It's not a bad analogy, not exactly, yeah. But not a bad one.
And so you have a backup system for that, of course?
Well, there are two ways we could back it up. And initially we said, oh, well, it's no problem. This science data formatter is in a bigger box called a science instrument command and data handling box, which actually has two science data formatters, and they're powered by separate power sources. Mm-hmm. So you kind of have a side A and a side B. So we could switch over to side B and be back in business. One of the problems, though, is that we haven't used side B on the spacecraft in 18 years.
Wow.
Never had to.
Just been sitting.
Nothing on side A's ever failed.
Yeah.
So that was one option. We could proceed with the mission next week, October 14th, or a week and a half from now.
And switch that over to just side...
to side B.
But then you'd have no backup for side B.
Exactly. And that was the key point. But we just happened to have, there were some smart people 20, 30 years ago, and said this SIC and DH unit is very important. We ought to build a backup system, a duplicate of it, while we're building the first one, because it's cheaper to do that. So there was a second SIC and DH built back in the late 1980s, and it's been sitting at Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt for the last 18 years, waiting to be called upon. And we periodically powered up the last time in 2001, and it worked fine. So we made the decision, if we can delay the mission 2 or 3 months, 4 months maybe, and get this ready, we could then do the mission and have a fully redundant system again with backups. And we chose to go that course.
That's interesting. Did you know that it was sitting on the shelf out there? And people have to say, hey, you know, we got one out there at Goddard.
Well, I should have known it because I've been on this program 31 years, but you know, I probably had forgotten it, but luckily somebody remembered. But so, it took us only a few hours to make the decision once we realized what all our options were. Things happened very fast.
Yeah.
What I just described all happened within 24 hours.
Wow. So you swap out that unit.
Yes, we'll add that to the list of things we'll work on, and we're hoping to be able to fly. And the shuttle has really been helpful for us scientists. It's found a way to meet our requirements for launch sometime probably in the February timeframe, just mm-hmm. next year.
And so sometime in February, no real hard, fast date yet.
It's probably mid-February timeframe. They'll probably be setting a more hard date in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things will you be repairing up there?
Well, we're going to be putting in two brand-new instruments, a new spectrograph and a new camera. And we're going to be replacing all six gyros. Unlike computer parts, gyros have moving parts and they wear out. So we replaced gyros many times over 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're replacing the batteries for the first time in 18 years. And
wow, they kept going.
Rods and ends. Wow. And we're repairing two instruments that are dead, but we think we have a way to fix them and bring back to life two instruments worth $250 million.
Wow. You mean to just do you have to take out the wrenches and repair them there, or do you have to replacements for those?
No, what we do is the astronauts, believe it or not, in spacesuits and thick gloves, have found ways they can actually open up the instruments, pull out failed computer cards, and put new ones in and rewire some things. It's it takes hours and hours, but it's worth a shot. Right now, you got nothing to lose. They're both dead. We think we can repair at least one, maybe both of them.
Mm-hmm. What do we expect to learn from these new instruments that you're putting on there?
Well, the new camera is going to both instruments together will make Hubble more powerful than it's ever been. In fact, it's not like having a brand new telescope. It'll be more sensitive and have new ability to look into different wavelengths like the ultraviolet and the infrared. Mm-hmm. I always hesitate, having worked on this program so long, of telling you the good science that's going to be done by the new instruments, because every time I do that, we launch it, and then they make all these discoveries that we never anticipated, which are far more important than anything we had planned.
So you say low expectations. You have great rewards.
Common
that come
thing
back
these days, right?
Yeah, that's right. Even in the space business. Because, they declared the shuttle dead in 1990, the Hubble dead in 1990, didn't they?
Right. After we launched it, we discovered we had a really big problem that couldn't be fixed in orbit, namely the main 96-inch mirror was perfectly smooth and had a great curve on it. The only one problem is the prescription on the curve was wrong.
Yeah.
But luckily, over the course of 2 or 3 years, we discovered that we could make small, tiny adjustments in the internal optics of new instruments. And actually, just like when you put your glasses on, if you're nearsighted, you turn an imperfect eye into a perfect eye.
So how much of the original Hubble remains at this point?
Actually, other than the mirror, not much. We've replaced the gyros many times. We replaced all the instruments, some of the reaction wheels. We replaced a transmitter. We replaced fine guidance sensors. There's not much left of the original telescope other than the structure and the mirrors.
And how long do you think this might last now? Have we got another 18 years?
No, because we won't have the shuttle to service it after about 2010. I think this last servicing mission should give us at least 5 good years and maybe 6, 7, or 8 on top of that.
Now, what if a private space company decides that it could send its own spacecraft up? And we're talking, to Elon Musk and those people who now have gotten into orbit for the first time with private companies. Could NASA hire those people to do mission, service missions?
Well, at that point, it becomes a cost issue. To keep all these spare parts, it's like, you've got the only brand of car in the world, and you're suddenly responsible for maintaining all the infrastructure, all the spare parts for it. We knew this was going to be the last servicing mission, so we stopped making gyros and stopped making fine guidance sensors. And trying to rebuild that infrastructure would be enormously expensive, and it's probably cheaper to build a new telescope from scratch.
And they're working on that one, too.
That's called James Webb Space Telescope.
And when would we expect that one?
2013. It's actually only 4.5 years away now. And it's much larger than Hubble, 6.5 meters as opposed to 2.4 meters, and far, far more sensitive because it works in the infrared.
I always called the Hubble like the jewel of NASA. Because it makes pictures that more people see, gives more publicity for NASA than anything else, I think. And it's good to see that these great pictures will still be coming back. And you say we might get other pictures because of a different wavelength.
Oh, yeah. We have a new wide-field planetary camera 3, which will give us even more sensitivity and new colors, so to speak, new wavelengths. Mm-hmm. So the pictures will continue.
And what would you be pointing them at? Extrasolar planets or galaxies or everything?
We will be looking at, hopefully we'll be able to analyze the atmospheres of some of these new planets they're finding. And one of the big pushes will be to try to get ready for the James Webb Space Telescope by looking even deeper into the universe and finding some good candidates for the first galaxies that were born, the first stars that were born. And we'll be looking for exploding stars, which give us some clues into the mysterious dark energy that was just discovered about 5 to 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be seeing the new images of the Hubble being uploaded to your website?
Oh, absolutely. That's the nice thing about Hubble. It is the people's telescope. Everything we take pictures of is on the website within months.
Mm-hmm. How confident are you in this new format or Side B going to work? Pretty sure.
Oh, I'm very confident because the instrument that was built, the copy of the instrument on the ground, as I said, it's an exact duplicate, and it'll go through full and total functional testing on the ground before it goes up there. And it's the copy of an instrument that worked 18 years successfully in orbit.
Yeah, that's interesting. Did you ever imagine that the Hubble would still be working today?
No, right. I thought the Hubble would retire far, far quicker than I will, and I'm wondering now if I'll make it as long as the Hubble's going to last. We were hoping for a 10 to 15 year mission, and we're 18 years going strong, looking at another 5 to 10 probably.
Well, why do you think that is? Because of good quality control? What makes you think? Just a really good design? I mean, there are certain things, even like the Mars rovers, that are going way past their expected lifetime.
Well, it's not uncommon in space. If you launch something and it survives the first month or two, and we call that infant mortality, if something's going to break in space, it usually breaks the first time you turn it on or the first time it's exposed to vacuum. If it makes it through the first couple months, things tend to last a long time up there because the environment's pretty stable and pretty benign. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't rain much in space.
Yeah. And the computer for the Hubble was built in the 1980s, so it's ancient.
Right now, we upgraded the computer. We're now using a 486 computer.
Wow.
But I'll tell you something. I'm an old-fashioned guy, too. Sometimes I wish I had my Mac Plus. The old computer, the old technology wasn't so bad, and Hubble's a good proof of it.
I've got a Plus and a 2CI in my basement.
There you go.
If you're still interested in one, I can send it right off to you.
But
those old things, they really were built quite solidly.
And so I think you got a lot more capability than new computers, but I'm not sure they're more reliable.
All right, Ed, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. And you're shooting for mid-February?
Mid-February, and we should start producing science probably two months or so after that.
All right, good luck. Ed Weiler is Associate Administrator of the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington. We're going to take a short break. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Change gears and bring a whole different topic into focus. We're going to talk about invention and especially about Flash of Genius. It's a movie that I got to see yesterday. It's a terrific film. I highly recommend it. We're going to have Greg Kinnear here, Mark Abraham is who's the producer, and John Seabrook, who's the staff writer of The New Yorker, also wrote a book called Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Back in the 1960s, an electrical engineer named Bob Kearns had a eureka moment. Actually, probably in the 50s, I think, is when it happened. What if windshield wipers blinked just like the human eye, pausing for a few seconds between wipes and a little drizzle? He holed up in his Detroit basement for months to come, working on a prototype, and he finally turned his flash of genius into real working intermittent wipers and a patent. Of course, he didn't call them intermittent wipers at that time, but that's a good story that we're going to get into, only to see his idea wind up in Detroit in a car that he had no idea that he accused Detroit of stealing his idea, and he spent the next decade or so fighting the giant automakers for recognition. Well, my next guests were all sucked up into a tale of this stubborn inventor, and the story is called Flash of Genius. It first appeared in The New Yorker, and it hits the big screen today, and joining me now to talk about it are my guests. John Seabrook is a staff writer at The New Yorker, also author of Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention, a new book out just last month. He's here with us in our studios in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ira.
Thank you. Mark Abraham is a movie producer out of Los Angeles, and he makes his directorial debut with Flash of Genius, and he joins us here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
And Greg Kinnear is an Oscar-nominated actor. He plays the inventor Bob Kearns in Flash of Genius. Welcome. To the program. Did you enjoy how did you prepare for this role?
Well, I didn't have the unfortunately, I never met him, and I would have liked to have met the man. His children and his wife Phyllis were came by the set. I had a chance to meet all of them, and they were great. They were very helpful, just in terms of talking rather openly about who their father was and what this fight of his against Ford was all about. There was some footage of him in the courtroom. Ed Bradley did a nice piece on him. He went on Letterman when Letterman used to be over at NBC in a funny spot one time. So there were a few bits and pieces to draw from, but you know, as I've said, it's not like doing Nixon. Nobody's ever going to stand up in the theater and say, that's not how I remember the man who invented the intermittent wiper to be. So we had a broad canvas, but we certainly tried to be as authentic as
right.
we could.
John, let's talk about how that flash of genius occurred. What was the original story really about? How did that happen? It's really a story of a lone inventor. And
yeah,
his
my interest in writing the story was, here was this contest between an individual and a corporation, and it was about who invented the intermittent windshield wiper. And it seemed like a good way of getting into the patent system and examining just who the patent system favors and who has the advantage in a patent case. And my take on it was that the patent system was invented in the 18th century when most inventors were individuals. And here we are in the, you know, mid to late 20th, when I was writing the story of the late 20th century, when most inventions come from corporations. But when you get into a courtroom and you have an individual versus a corporation, in many ways the individual has the advantage, because a lot of people still want to believe that in that individual flash of genius. And also the story that Kearns told about how he had that idea, which was his wedding night. He was opening a bottle of champagne. The cork goes off and hits him in the eye. And as a result, he starts thinking a lot about why eyes work and don't work. And then he has the idea to make a windshield wiper like an eye. I think in the courtroom, when people heard that story, they said, oh, this is how invention happens, creative things happen from pain and from loss, and from misfortune comes something good. And that, I think, really kind of twigged in people's minds. And so my interest was in those issues. In the film, I think it's much more about Bob's own personal story and what he lost.
Mark Abraham, how did it get to you? How did you discover?
Well, one of the producers, Mike Lieber, and John actually made available to me the article. I hadn't read John's article when it actually came out. I read it a few years later. I read the article. I just loved it. I just thought, what a great story. This guy, and he's a 34-year-old college professor. He's got six children. He's a devout Catholic. He's down in tinkering. He's got a personal handicap. He comes up with this idea and then has it taken from him and decides, rather than just accept it or be paid off and go back and decide I'll come up with a new mashed potato machine or whatever the hell he was going to do, he decides to fight for his credit and for his dignity. And I just thought, to me, that's the stuff of great American literature. And even though it's a silly concept about an intermittent windshield wiper, it really isn't about that. It's about principles. So I just got caught up in it.
So in your movie pitch, you didn't go in and say, it's about an intermittent windshield wiper.
that's a guaranteed sell right there. What are you talking about? That's a winner. You just in a second, they're buying that up.
Exactly. But the film does show, goes full circle about the family and his family life, having the close family, losing it, coming back to his family. Yeah. It's really about the family.
It is. It's about fatherhood. It's about being gone. It's about being absent. It's about what you leave. What's the legacy? And, you know, look, he was clearly not a great father. And interesting, a lot of friends of mine have said it made them think about being dads, because not that they all went as far as Bob Kearns went, but it is about the cost of a battle like this, and certainly this battle took its toll.
Greg, this is not a terribly likable character in this film, although you feel sorry for him sometimes. There's the scene with Alan Alda, who's his first lawyer. It's the first, only one really in the who starts to comment what a pain in the butt this guy is to deal with. How do you resist from turning him into that kind of character that everybody would love?
Yeah, I like that Alan Alda plays the attorney who tries to explain to Bob, this is how justice works in our country. And he points out that Bob was not the most charming man to walk into the room. And I had some sense of that from certainly from John's, I think time that he spent with him and talking to the kids. I mean, he did seem to be a little abrasive, a little distrustful and a little abrupt. I mean, I don't think he was a bad guy. I did feel like there was definitely this underlying decency to him, and that's what hopefully makes people root for him. But what I liked about Mark's addressing this movie is there's a lot of happy ending movies out there, and I don't feel like this movie asks for you to like your guy that you're following in the story. We don't pander to the audience. I feel like, you know, we gave you a pretty straightforward guy who's a little, if anything, prickly, and you have to like him warts and all if you want to get on board the journey.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Greg Kinnear, who plays the inventor Bob Kearns in Flash of Genius, also Mark Abraham, movie producer out in Los Angeles, made his first directorial debut.
Yeah.
You have fun?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a great experience, one of the most challenging experiences. It's such an intense day-to-day thing. Every day you have this dream about how you expect it to be and, you know, what the settings are going to be and mm-hmm. how – and the every day that gets crashes at about 80 miles an hour up into reality. You don't have enough money. You don't have enough time. The sun's going away. But I loved it. I love working with the actors. That's rewarding aspect.
Also, John Seabrook, author of Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. And you actually did meet.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Bob.
How does he match up to the character in the film?
Well, Greg does a great job with his face of really – Bob had this quality in his face. I call it Midwestern angst. I'm not sure.
Carry it with me everywhere I go.
And maybe it's because Greg comes from the Midwest too, but there's something about the way that Greg uses his face to sort of – he's certain, but behind that certainty, maybe he's not so certain, which is very much Bob Kearns. In real life, Bob Kearns was a good deal more difficult to deal with than you see in the film, at least by the time I encountered him, which was, you know, well along into this whole Patton odyssey of his. Mm-hmm. But he had become very, very sort of rooted in this thing, and there was very little oxygen around him. He was just consumed, and even in the end when he won, he wasn't really very happy because the court never found for willful infringement, which they do make that distinction in the movie. One of the things the movie does really well is it actually lays out these complicated legal issues in a very clear way that doesn't interrupt the flow of the film at all. At any rate, Bob was dissatisfied with that, and as a matter of fact, he didn't even cash the check. He got $18 million from Chrysler, and he didn't cash a check for 7 years because he was so mad at the judge for taking, I think he took $10 million of that and paid off all of it. He had four different sets of lawyers,
right?
And all of whom eventually quit. And so the judge had to sort of distribute the money, and Bob was so mad about that that he just refused to spend it until one of his sons finally said, come on, Dad, can't we just go to the bank?
Let's go there. You can get the $18 million, Dad. But Bob also, it wasn't just his anger. I mean, he genuinely felt that judge had ulterior motives in that judgment.
That's right. The judge, who was named Avern Cohen, was from a pretty prominent Detroit family who had many connections, whose family had connections in the automobile industry, as practically every, you know, prominent family mm-hmm. in Detroit would. But Bob was very suspicious of he was very suspicious of me, actually, when I first approached him. It took me days to persuade him that I wasn't actually working for, you know, Ford or General Motors.
Well, that was the interesting part, because in the beginning of the movie, it's set up at him teaching a class of ethics. This was paramount in his life. He said, you know, you can be an engineer, but ethics is going to be the motivating force, and that's the whole theme of his search,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And what's important is I wasn't concerned as a filmmaker and didn't want to impart with Greg anything that went beyond the tale of where the story was. Or else there's no character arc. And when Bob started, and you look at the pictures and you see that, he was this happy guy. And he was a guy who thought he was dreaming, the American dream was there. So it was very important for the actor to be able to bring you that warmth, as well as ultimately when he does mm-hmm. have a nervous breakdown. That's what I thought was most important about that. In the end, when it went on and on and on, actually the movie doesn't go that far in it.
There's also an interesting scene when we were mentioning Alan Alda as his lawyer. Where he tells Bob Kearns, you may want money, but we're going to get you justice.
Yeah.
Justice. And have audiences responded to that when you showed?
It's really interesting because in the last month of us showing the film, as things have started to happen in this country that have put a lot of pressure on people financially and feeling suddenly that they've all been marginalized, and you can just feel it, you see it. It's mm-hmm. clearly, it's not, you know, profound to say that. What's interesting, while they watch that scene, there's been a palpable sense in the movie theater of when Alan Alda says, Bob says, what about this little thing called justice? And Alan says, this is justice in America. This is how you get what justice is. You don't get a ticker tape parade. The mayor doesn't give you a key to the city. You get a check. And people have now started
talking. Not anymore. You don't even get a check anymore.
People have started talking back to the screen now. It's funny.
Is that right?
People have said, yeah, you tell them. You know, they are feeling that this character is somehow embodying their frustrations. And look, I don't know what that means or doesn't mean. I mean, art isn't our goal. But it is interesting that it's resonating deeper. It's definitely something's happening.
And this is not a real action movie. You've put a lot of burden on Greg to carry with his facial expressions and his acting and his long scenes of just him alone.
Yes.
And he does very well.
Yeah, I watched him and marveled because there's things that people don't – a lot of times these days in movies, there's a lot of camera movement to mask actual acting. Well, Greg understands how to do that. There's a scene at the end of the picture in the courtroom, and it's a 2 minutes or more of just the camera being there on Bob Kearns. And that's not – there's no tricks there. That's – either you got a guy who can carry it or a guy who doesn't. And Greg just, it's beautiful. And when we did it, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning in the courtroom and the entire group of people just spontaneously started applauding. It was really moving.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from MTR News. I'm Ira Flato with John Seabrook, Mark Abraham, and Greg Kinnear talking about Flash of Genius, the new film that's coming out today.
Great. Yeah, that's right.
In a theater near you.
At a
local theater. How was that courtroom scene to film?
Just turn on your intermittent wipers and get in the car, drive on down the road. How was
the courtroom scene?
Well, the courtroom was interesting because, you know, I was playing a guy who, you know, he's not a trained lawyer. I mean, Bob, you know, he kind of learned his own road to get to that place. He kind of followed his own got his own education on that. And so, you know, it's a chewy thing to be able to play an actor in the big courtroom scene. You always look forward to that. And here I am playing, unfortunately, a guy who is not really have the equipment to be there. And so playing kind of his nervousness and kind of his that awkwardness was actually kind of fun in a way. And the courtroom was really beautiful. It was shot – the movie was shot by Dante Spinotti, who is a, you know, wonderful Academy Award winning Academy Award nominated cinematographer. And the pictures in there and I think the whole look of the film is really extraordinary.
It is. There are great scenes in the movie where other young inventors come around him as their hero. And I'm just wondering, John, does it make the case, and you make the case for these garage inventors as being these heroes?
I'll say two things about that. One is that that is very true to reality. When I was in the courtroom while the trials were going on, there were always inventors out in the halls and in the audience. And at all the breaks, they would gather around Bob and people would whisper, oh, there goes the man who invented the windshield wiper, you know.
The pocket protector crap.
It was exciting. It was exciting. I think every garage inventor in America, and there still are a whole lot of them, is going to go to this film and be delighted that here's a film that's actually made about one of them that shows what they have to deal with. Because if you talk to any inventor you talk to, he will say that there's this kind of not invented here syndrome in American corporations that, you know, if they didn't come up with it in their big research lab with all their engineers, then they're not interested in getting it from somewhere else.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the play on Broadway about the Farnsworth invention. Yeah,
exactly.
Recently.
Right.
That was about that.
But it's interesting if you go to Google and you hit that little tab on the right that says more and you go down, they have that patents. They got a new patents list on Google and you can put in any idea in the world there. And it also lists all of the patents year to year that are currently being made and that have been patented. And all of them, you go to the top 10, they're all virtually huge corporations. The idea of an individual creating something is seems nostalgic.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Gordon Gould story of the laser invention?
Yep.
You didn't put that one in your book. I thought that would be...
What is that? Am I asking? Are we wasting time? Do all your listeners know the Gordon Gould?
Tell them. Give us a minute. I got a minute
go
before
ahead.
The break.
Refresh my memory a little
this
bit.
This is about a guy who took 30 years to win the right to be the inventor of the laser. Two guys had already won Nobel Prizes for it. And he was a graduate student at Columbia, and this professor was down the hall from him, and he came up with this thing virtually overnight. He stood up in bed, wrote some notes on it, went down to the local store, maybe on the Upper West Side, got it notarized, And that's how that was used in the court. It took him 30 years also to finally win the recognition. He won millions and millions and millions of dollars given away to most of his lawyers.
I smell a sequel. All
right, we have to take a break. We'll come right back after this this short break and talk lots more with John Seabrook, Mark Abraham, and Greg Kinnear. Flash of Genius, premiering today. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Flash of Genius, the new movie about the man who invented the intermittent windshield wiper, out in theaters today. Also, that's the name of the book written by John Seabrook, Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. John Seabrook is here. Also along with us is Mark Abraham, who is a movie producer and first-time director. Greg Kinnear, Oscar-nominated actor. He plays inventor Bob Kearns in Flash of Genius. Greg, can this kind of stuff get in your system and do more sort of roles like this?
Well, I've done a few real-life people, before, and I, this kind of character, it's always fun. I mean, it's still the same job, to try and find somebody, and the bottom line is, in its most simple form, is to try and make the audience believe you.
Yeah.
And we were lucky with Bob because he was such a specific guy. I felt like, but at the end of the day, I don't know. There's so many real-life stories. I don't know if audiences really care one way or the other. I think they're looking for a good emotional story, and the fact that it's a true story or not, even though we seem to have passed through that tunnel already, and now we're on to, well, what do you got to tell me? What's the journey? And I think this has got a good journey.
Yeah. John, are there the other inventors in your book, are they more like this kind of storyline or— –
They're all obsessives. I mean, I think you kind of have to be, because you work alone— – and without a whole lot of prospect of success. I mean, you have to be really devoted to what you're doing. So one of them is a guy who figured out there was this machine called the Antikythera mechanism, this ancient Greek computer found at the bottom of the ocean 100 years ago, which was made 2,000 years ago. And for many, many years after it was found, no one could understand what it was. And this guy was able to sort of methodically figure out exactly what all the gears did. Wow. It was a calculating machine for stars.
And you come from a famous inventing family, Seabrook.
My family were one of the first people to get in the frozen food business. And my uncle Courtney, this is actually why I got so interested, I think, in inventors, is when I was a little kid, every time we would have frozen food, my dad would say, "Your Uncle Courtney invented that boil-in-the-pouch bag." Every time we stick it down in the boiling pan of water.
I didn't know that.
It's fame right here.
Wow! And something about the quotidian nature of it was actually one of the things that attracted me to the windshield wipers. I mean, there are these little everyday things all around us that we don't really think about, and yet there's a story behind them, and somebody's flash of genius is responsible for that thing. So. That was my little flash of genius.
Yeah, I mean, it might be. I agree. I mean, it seems nostalgic, I guess, the idea that every little knob and switch and widget, these days came from just one person. But the truth is, whether you're working under the umbrella of a corporation or not, it starts with the idea of one guy.
1-800-989-8255. Let me see if I can get a quick phone call or two from Steve in Oregon, Ohio.
Hello, Ira.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you today?
How are you? Go ahead.
Great show. I'm great, thanks. Listen, I'm the inventor of the laser level, the patent 5836081. And my story actually is similar to begin with, but we prevailed. I didn't have the funds to even get the patent, so I talked the patent attorney into paying for the patent and doing the whole process. And we did receive the patent, and I contacted some large companies, and nobody was interested. Nobody's beating our doors down for laser levels at this time. Kind of funny.
We never know who's going to phone into our program. So.
I listen to you guys all the time. I'm on my way bass fishing in the marshes right now. So.
Well, have a good weekend, Steve.
A great day.
Thanks for calling.
I
got to go. We're running out of time. Let me ask you one more question, John. And I forgot what that question was. Are there stories in the film that were not in your essay or in the book that you learned later that were included in the film, parts of the story?
There are some things that I didn't have a chance to put into my book or my piece that I talked with a screenwriter about, and that actually then made it into the film. It was kind of like a second chance for some of these things that I knew about Bob. And then there's some stuff in the film that the screenwriter kind of invented that mm-hmm. you know, wasn't in the piece. But a lot of the film is remarkably close to the piece, which is why I love the film. One reason why I love the film is it really is true in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, was it tough? Was there a lot of stuff that wound up on the floor here? Not really.
Yeah? I tell you, John's a fantastic writer. He's such an even hand, but he kind of sucks you in. And when you read the piece, that's how I felt. And it was such a great template for a screenplay. Honestly, we followed it very, very closely. The only thing we did is we condensed time, which you always do in a film. You condense time and space because it's not mm-hmm. three-dimensional, but
right.
not a lot in on the floor.
Did you have a model of a movie in your mind that you wanted it to look like?
Yeah. Yeah. I did. I was very much a fan of the movies of the 70s, where, for instance, one of the key films that I was inspired by was All the President's Men, where Bob Redford wears the same corduroy jacket with the patch pockets through the whole film, because that's what people do. Bob wears the same outfit. And it also has a certain veracity, the way the lights hit things, the shadows. You feel like you're inside that movie. You feel like Ben Bradley being played by Jason Robards. And that was kind of what Dante and I chose to go for. And Greg has this naturalistic way of acting where he's, you don't even know it. I mean, you get caught up in watching him, and you do get lost. I mean, when the family came, they would literally, he was like he was in the museum. They came, and they would look at him and stare like, is this, they weren't sure if it was their dad or if it was Greg.
Because it was a big family, and they
six.
Six.
And mom.
And they formed a company that did nothing but defend his reputation.
Yeah. I mean,
that was their business.
Essentially, it became their business for quite a while. I mean, eventually they went on to do other things. But it's interesting, that legacy that Bob left them about justice and about principle, even though a lot of other pain this family went through and mm-hmm. a lot of dysfunction, to this day, they all have a certain reverential feeling about their dad because he gave them something, and what he gave them was a code.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good place to end it. Gentlemen, I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us, and good luck with the film. It's a great film. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. We appreciate that very much.
Greg Kinnear, Oscar-nominated actor. He plays Bob Kearns in Flash of Genius. Mark Abraham is the movie's producer. First time he's a movie producer, but this is his first time directing a film, Flash of Genius. And John Seabrook, a staff writer at The New Yorker, also author of Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention, a book out last month. Thank you. Have a good weekend. Shifting gears now. Earlier this year, Senators John Warner and Joe Lieberman took a stab at regulating America's greenhouse gases with a cap-and-trade bill. Of course, you know it crashed and burned in the Senate. But now 10 eastern states have united and tackled the problem themselves, and they've joined forces to form a group called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI for short. Last week, they put out over 12 million carbon emission permits on the auction block, and power companies were scrambling to buy up the permits to pollute. So the states wound up with a lot of cash in the bank. But what are they going to have to do with it? And is this a local action enough to clear up the skies? And why do states have to do this and not the federal government? Joining me to talk about the greenhouse gas auction is Peter Iwanowitz. He is director of the New York State Office of Climate Change, also chair of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative Auction Committee. He joins us from the state capital, Albany, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Were you happy with the outcome of the auction?
Yeah, we were pleased. You know, for the first time ever in the U.S., a regional effort like this has been unfolding, and we actually, for the first time ever in the U.S., we auctioned off CO2 emissions allowances. Has never been done before in this country. So we were actually very pleased with the initial startup of the auction. Mm-hmm. We have a follow-up auction coming in December before any power companies have a compliance obligation starting in 2009. So far, so good in our eyes.
Why do 10 states have to do this? Why do the states have this and not the federal government?
Well, it actually started 5 years ago, and it was sort of a reaction to what happened in 2001. When the Bush administration took a reversal of course and decided not to participate in the Kyoto Accord. There was some frustration here in New York, and New York State created a climate change task force that recommended dealing with the power sector first. And then after that recommendation, then Governor Pataki issued a letter to the northeastern state governors calling on them to come together. First meeting of staff was actually September 11th, 2003. And since that time, staffs across the region have been working on the fine details of the regulations and the auction platform, meeting with stakeholders and nearly two dozen meetings of stakeholders have transpired. So it's been a long time in coming, but I think it's just a typical reaction of states filling the void in the presence of federal inaction. It's been historic over many different environmental issues, acid rain being another one. So the states decided we're going to lead. And notwithstanding the sort of demise of the Liebman-Warner bill, the states decided to continue to move ahead.
Mm-hmm. The cap of 18 million tons is actually higher than the emissions were last year, right?
In New York State, we have a cap of 64.3 million tons. That's sort of within the overarching regional cap of 188 million tons. Actual emissions are a little bit lower than that if you look at just 1 year's worth of data for 2006. And 2007 creeps upward again. So the actual power plants covered by this are emitting a little bit less due to we haven't had as many extreme heat waves in the Northeast as we had in the early part of this decade. But also with oil prices being high, power plants that can burn either oil or natural gas are actually burning more natural gas, which is a lower CO2 emissions rate. So we're seeing pricing signals also driving down CO2 emissions.
Do you think this is going to make any real difference, any real dent in the larger problem?
You know, any CO2 you remove from the atmosphere now is going to make a difference. Carbon dioxide emitted today, a third of it is going to be around 100 years from now. So all we can do to reduce emissions now, sending the right price signals, setting up a cap and trade program where people have to actually buy permission to pollute, that will drive down CO2 emissions right away. Is it enough? Certainly not. It's a good first step on the pathway to what we hope will be a national cap and trade program, and indeed linking a national program with other efforts that are already underway across the globe. Mm.
Do you think more states are now going to start programs like this?
Well, we've already seen, after REGGIE was created, we've seen the creation of a Western Climate Initiative. They are going to take the cap and trade program a bit beyond the power sector. So we're not only seeing other regional efforts grow up, they're going to be expanding upon our initial concept. Western Climate Initiative have their design elements out there of what they aspire to reach, what they would like to do for auctioning. You know, if the federal government doesn't act, we in New York envision linking our scheme in the Northeast with the Western Climate Initiative. And there's also in the heart of coal country in the Midwest, a bunch of governors got together just about a year ago and committed to doing a regional program in the Midwest involving pretty big coal-intensive states like Illinois. So we're really encouraged by the progress we started 5 years ago, the fact that we've got an auction up and running and a cap-and-trade program ready to be effective in January. Now you're seeing these other regions come together, too. Mm-hmm. So if the federal government doesn't get their act together, states are going to continue to do this stuff.
Mm-hmm. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Peter Iwanowitz, who is director of the New York State Office of Climate Change. Give us an idea, for those of us who don't know what a cap-and-trade system is, how it works.
Sure. What happens is we have a regulation that caps, I mean, sets a limit on the amount of emissions that a power plant can belch out. In this case, we're setting a cap on the overall emissions of carbon dioxide. So there's a permit condition they can't exceed above sort of this cap. There's just not any more left in it. So over time, our cap gets reduced, so making it more and more difficult for power companies to continually to belch out what they're currently doing. The trade portion is sort of like what happens back and forth when you either have more allowances than you need and you sell them to somebody who needs them, or if you have less, you have to actually go out and buy them in a sort of a trading system. Mm-hmm. This has been going on for about 15 years under the acid rain cleanup program.
Right.
We've taken a little bit different twist with this cap and trade approach because we're actually, instead of handing away allowances based on power plant's historical emissions, we're now saying you have to come to either an auction or go to a secondary market, like a trading floor, and purchase these limited authorizations to emit or a CO2 emissions allowance.
Hmm.
And that's a little bit different. And the new twist is involving states actually auctioning off these pollution emission allowances.
And the states that sold shares made $39 million in the auction. Where does that money go?
Well, there's 10 states in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and all states participated. Six had their regulations done and ready to go. So those six states offered up their tons for sale last week at an auction. The proceeds then flow back to those six states, and it's nearly $40 million worth of funds. And the states have committed to use those proceeds for things like additional energy efficiency, programs to do low-income weatherization, to fund more deployment of robust renewables like solar and wind, and do other innovative non-carbon technologies so that we can not only put the money back to the public that has now been generated by these auction proceeds, but we can fund things that will further drive down energy consumption and thereby reduce even more CO2 than just the cap would.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's a very promising beginning here?
Yeah, we're pleased with the start. We think the auction was robust, and we had a fair number of participants. The fact that there were clamoring for more than four times the allowances that we were putting out for sale, and the clearing price being set by the power companies, because most of the allowances were purchased by the power companies, that really is a good sign that we have a good, robust market that we've designed and a very good auction design as well.
Well, Peter, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
No, my pleasure. Good. I really appreciate going over the details of this important program.
You're welcome. Peter Iwanowitz is director of the New York State Office of Climate Change, also chair of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative Auction Committee. Next up, it's our pick of the week, our Science Friday video, and Flora Lichtman, who is here to tell us what she's got up there on our website today.
Hey, Ira.
Hi there.
So this week, we are investigating the science of camouflage. There is a new camouflage line that has been designed with deer vision in mind.
So you get to see how it looks like to a hunter. Might dressed in camouflage look like to a deer?
Right. So you can see deerovision on our website, basically. Deer do not see the world exactly like humans do. And the idea is if you can tap into that biology, maybe you can make a camouflage that is more invisible for hunters.
Wow. So if you go to sciencefriday.com and look, click on the little video pick of the week, we're going to see the deer, the deerovision.
Deerovision.
Thank you, Flora.
Sure.
We'll see you next week with the next Science Friday pick of the week. And that's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director, and Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Our intern is Molly Ashford. Josh Rogerson is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. And in Second Life, we had help from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got the pick of the week up there and dozens of other videos that Flora has made for you. Also, you can podcast our Science Friday videos and audios, and also send us email and get involved in our blogs. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.